Okay, let's see. Got one more button to press over here. Okay, everything should be recording and sending, and hopefully DishNuts will work tonight. I've had a problem, I guess, for the last month. I don't know. All right, this is KK5DO. And let me get this. Let's see, where's the... there it is. QST, this is Bruce, KK5DO, and it is once again time for another edition of the Houston AMSAT Net. This net meets on Tuesdays to discuss topics related to satellites, balloons, and other amateur radio-related items. This is net number 1669, and it's 8 p.m. Central Time on Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026, which in UTC time is Wednesday, June 24th, 2026, at 0100. Sorry, this net is only being heard on Echolink and our normal streaming service, DishNuts, I hope, as it hasn't been. I can't reach the repeater in Houston from my house, so this will have to do till Marty gets back. URLs for this evening's net are located at amsatnet.com. So far, well, I've recorded more bytes than I have normally done on these days. So hopefully the DishNuts is still working. AMSAT News Service Bulletin, number 172 for June 21st. All right. Of course, it talks about Field Day is this coming Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Friday setup, Saturday operation, Sunday morning operation. So wherever you're going to participate, have fun. We're all set up here. I am not even sure what call sign our club is going to use. So I guess I'll find out on Friday and I'll work the satellites for them. The AMSAT 44th Space Symposium, October 8th through 11th. We've been beating this one to death for the past few weeks. We'll do it some more. Technical paper sessions on golf, satellites, CubeSat Sim, ARIS updates, the annual general meeting and awards, AMSAT board meeting, entertaining. They've got the AMSAT fundraiser auction. That is always so much fun. They get all kinds of stuff. Last time there was the, let's see what they have, a few of the white coats that were used inside the lab when working on AO40. So those were kind of neat. Then we have the banquet with door prizes. I was fortunate to have won one last year, and it was a CubeSat Sim. So I've had fun playing with that. Live streaming for remote attendees. We really like to have you there, but if you can't make it, you can watch it live streamed. More information on that will be on the, probably on X, and of course the AMSAT YouTube channel. There is a free airport shuttle, so it's easy fly-in, because obviously you're going into an airport, and it's going to be at the Jacksonville Airport, JAX. You can go to the AMSAT.org website, and you can register for the hotel right there, so everything's all set up. Special for the ladies or the XYL, activities and a spouse program. I'm not sure about the optional tours on Sunday. That may not be for just the ladies because a visit to the USS Orlick might be something I'd like to go do. And then, of course, the Jacksonville Zoo. We'll have special rates for getting in there and doing that, so that should be fun. If you'd like to reserve your hotel, you can call the hotel directly, 800-227-6963. Use the group code AMS. The direct phone number to the hotel, should you need to talk with them, is 904-741-4404. And this is an interesting story. Satellites are the new fire towers. So, you know that the parks, the national parks, they've got those fire towers all set up around the place, manned by park rangers, just in case there's a fire somewhere, they can detect it. Well, the Bezos Earth Fund announced a $26 million grant for the nonprofit Earth Fire Alliance and its satellite-based wildfire detection program, Axos's Ben German reports. The money, alongside support from Google and others, will help fund the launch of 3 FireSat satellites this summer. The group say they'll provide wildfire monitoring at least twice daily over critical geographies, including a focus on the Amazon Basin, one of the most fire-vulnerable regions on Earth. The funding is the largest ever single philanthropic grant for wildfire detection, the group say. They add that the program could help protect homes, communities, and biodiversity and cut CO2 emissions from wildfires by up to 10% annually. There's a picture of the satellites if you'll go to the new service bulletin. Wildfires are a major driver of deforestation, which worsens climate change. They accounted for 42% of tree cover loss in 2025, per the World Resources Institute data. The Earth Fire Alliance says it hopes to have dozens of satellites operating by the early 2030s that can monitor every point on Earth every 20 minutes. That would really be interesting. So this story comes from Axios, and their website is axios.com. So we thank them for that interesting story. Now, announcing OrbitDeck, a new open-source desktop application called OrbitDeck brings the classic Oscar locator into the software age, pairing a faithful recreation of the beloved paper tracking aid with a built-in classroom of orbital mechanics lessons. Written in Python and released under the MIT license, OrbitDeck runs on Windows, macOS, and Linux, including the Raspberry Pi, and is tracking and analysis software only. Radio and rotor control are intentionally left to the excellent dedicated tools already serving that role. And let me drop the repeater on Echolink so that everyone has a chance to reset. Okay, continuing on with that story, longtime operators will remember the Oscar Locator, a polar map overlaid with a rotating ground track transparency that let you predict a pass with nothing but a pencil and a clock. OrbitDeck rebuilds that experience as an interactive on-screen Oscar Locator. You drag the map to rotate the path arc overlay across a polar or QTH-centered base map, watching the satellite's position and your station's footprint move in real time. A protractor-style rim with the per-degree tick marks and longitude and azimuth labels frames the disk. You can drive the overlay live, position it by hand to any equator crossing longitude, drag the marker along the arc to step through the minutes after the crossing, or seed it to directly to your next visible pass. A compact next equator crossing list is built in. Crucially, OrbitDeck also closes the loop with paper. Any satellite, real or hypothetical, can be exported as a printable PDF Oscar locator, ready to drop onto a clipboard for portable, screen-free operating in the field or in the classroom. that classroom focus runs throughout the program. A dedicated Learn section presents orbital mechanics across grouped interactive tabs. Kepler's equal areas law, anomalies, and vis-a-viva relation, nodal precession and sun synchronous orbits, slant range and footprint geometry, Doppler tune through eclipse and beta angle sunlight, a link budget sandbox, and element set aging, each with live diagram you can manipulate rather than merely read. A printable Orbits 101 handout rounds it out. The standout teaching tool is the Lab Satellite. From within the Oscar Locator simulator, you can invent a hypothetical bird and edit its orbital elements with sliders and entry boxes. Altitude with the period updating live. Eccentricity, inclination, RAAN, argument of perigee, mean anomaly, and direct apogee and perigee control. The ground track, footprint, and range circle respond instantly. Plain language explainers describe the effect of every change, and a gallery of presets loads recognizable archetypes from ISS like LEO to a millennia and geostationary. Design an orbit to a requirement, compare two designs side by side, then name and print your creation as an Oscar locator, exactly like a catalog satellite. OrbitDeck reads modern GP stroke OMM data, ships its own SGP4 propagator, and an offline catalog, so it works without a connection and is free to download. It is an inviting on-ramp for newcomers and genuinely useful operating and teaching aid for veterans. OrbitDeck builds and source code are available at its github.com/PROETZER/OrbitDeck. So that comes from Paul, N8HM. He's the VP or the executive VP of AMSAT. And he developed that program. So that's pretty neat. And looks like we're still flowing and working on DishNet. So I must have done everything right finally. Now, I don't see any changes to the AMSAT TLEs this week. So that's good. Of course, remember, July 15th, all the changes happen, supposedly. We'll see. Most things should still work. It's going to be like that year 2000. Everything was going to die and computers would never work again. And here we are in 2026 and they still work. So the sky is falling, Chicken Little. Now, here's an interesting story. Dragon returns packed with space station science. Of course, Dragon is the space shuttle thing that brings the astronauts back from the ISS. Scientists await a big splash in the Pacific Ocean as one of the most research-packed Dragon spacecraft to date returns, completing the 34th SpaceX commercial resupply mission to the ISS for NASA. Biological and material samples, along with tested hardware, are heading back to research teams on Earth for further analysis, advancing NASA's work to prepare humans for exploration beyond low Earth orbit and to deliver benefits back home. Some samples returning are the NASA's hematopoietic stem cell expansion in space, Pathfinder investigation. And then they've got a real big acronym here, which seeks to use the microgravity environment to scale up the production of stem cells. On Earth, lab-produced blood stem cells lose their ability to form different cell types like red and white blood cells that are critical to treating patients with certain blood diseases and cancers. In microgravity, researchers believe this ability will be better preserved while also growing these stem cells in greater numbers. The returning samples will undergo further analysis to determine if space-based efforts produce larger quantities of enhanced stem cells suitable for clinical use. The team behind NASA's Streptococcus pneumoniae infection of cardiac tissue experiment is awaiting the return of stem cell-derived heart tissues that were intentionally infected with a pneumonia-causing bacterium as part of ongoing microgravity research. Pneumonia increases the risk of heart disease, which is not fully understood because bacteria tend to become more active and virulent in microgravity. This experiment could amplify their effects, making it possible to detect cellular responses that cannot be observed on Earth. Then, we've got NASA's Megachirosite Flying 1. Samples are returning to Earth to help understand how large cells found in bone marrow, known as megakaryocytes, and the platelets they produce adapt to spaceflight. I'm getting tired of pronouncing that word, so we'll just say the M. And platelets play an important role in the formation of blood clots and immune responses. The returning samples, including those taken from astronauts, could show us how the human immune system reacts aboard the space station and help people prepare for future exploration missions. And let me take a quick break here for the Echolink connected repeaters. Okay. Semiconductor research samples as part of NASA's in-space production of semi-metal semiconductor composite bulk crystals in microgravity, that's a mouthful, investigation are returning to Earth for further analysis. This study manufactured semi-metal semiconductor composite alloy crystals in space, which have applications in many electronics, including sensors and lasers. Researchers believe microgravity could enable the production of significantly greater and higher quality crystals, supporting the development of next-generation semiconductor technologies. Additional experiments being returned include NASA's Zero Boil-Off Tank Non-Condensables investigation, NASA's DNA Nano Therapeutics 3 Space Assembly Assembled DNA-Inspired Materials, NASA's European Space Agency's Green Bone Marrow Investigation, NASA's 3D Bone Marrow Analog Research, and NASA's INSPA Auxilium Bioprinter Cell Printing is Investigation. Ooh, boy. That's all from NASA.gov. We thank them for that story. And that was pretty interesting. Recently completed ARIS contacts were with the youth on the air camp. They had theirs in Huntsville, Alabama, and it was completed on June 18th. So I'm sure all the kids were staying around the radio during that one. They would have had a good bunch of press there and everything as well. Upcoming contacts, National STEM Festival, which will be in Washington, D.C., and this will be on June 25th, so it's a few days away. So you might want to listen for that one. It's at, 1331 UTC, so that's when it starts. And that's all they've got scheduled here. And, of course, if you're trying to make a contact with the astronauts, all they have to do is go to the radio, turn up the volume, and start talking. But when should you listen? So, wake up to workday starts at 1.5 hours. The workday start to workday end is 12 hours. Workday end to sleep is 2 hours. Sleep to wake up is 8.5 hours. So guess what they do for the 2 hours between workday end and sleep? They're going to get something to eat, maybe. They're going to maybe get on a link and talk with their family. But that's when they're usually going to get on the air. Because don't forget, that workday that's 12 hours, their time up there is very, very valuable. So, when are they awake? They're awake at, from 7:30 to 19:30 UTC. So if you go and you calculate that up, add your 1.5 hours in there for wake up until the start of the workday, add your 12 hours, boom, you hit on the time when their workday ends and sleep will begin, and that's their 2 hours free. So think about that. Packet is active, 437.825 megahertz up and down. Ham TV is transmitting the test signal, 2.395 gigahertz. And, of course, the repeater's been working. I've been using that. I've been operating one of the special event stations for the 2026 soccer finals that are going on. So every day that they've had a game here in the Houston area, or here in Houston, I have operated the special event station, Whiskey 5 Charlie Stroke Hotel. And that's the Stroke Hotel is for Houston. There's also a Stroke Delta, which is for Dallas when they have their game. So I've got, I don't know, 30 or 40 people in the log already. It's been real rough. Today I couldn't even get on to SO50. I don't know. It must have been a holiday and everybody was off. But it was really busy. Didn't have much luck on the ISS. But I did get on RS-44, and I made a bunch of contacts there. So there in the log, they've got a really nice QSL card from Houston. And I believe they send them out automatically. I forget what it said. But you could go to QRZ.com and pull up Whiskey Charlie 5 Stroke Hotel, and you'll see the nice QSL card. There's another, let me see if I got that website here, where the all of the special event stations around the world are located. Let me see where to go. I think I put it over here so I wouldn't lose it. And then, of course, I don't know where I put it. Ah, here it is. Okay. That website is wc2026ses.org. So you can jump on over there, look and see all the stations worldwide. If you click on, I think there's a tab across top for QSL cards. But if you click on that, you'll see all of the QSL cards around the world. So if you happen to work them, cool. And then they've got a contest going. If you work one station, you get a certificate of whatever kind. If you work six, you get something else. You work a dozen, whatever it is, and you get a certificate. So go on over there. If you want to volunteer and you're in one of the areas where they're having a game, you can register there and get your time slot for operating. So that's kind of fun. All right, continuing on, or let me go acknowledge those that are over on Echolink with us. N6 UTC, end off. K9 OIM, Bob. N8 SGZ, David. KC5 LWY, Andrew. And ND0 HJ, Mitch. So we thank them for stopping by on Echolink and listening over there. I don't have my link up with the dishing up people, so sorry about that. Now, we've got some satellite shorts from all over the world, and I have been dying to see what kind of shorts those satellites wear. I still haven't been able to find out. HamSat Free and HamSat Pro, which has a one-time purchase, is an iOS satellite tracking app for iPhone, iPad, and it's by Vasco CT10Y. And he's recently updated it with new features, including compatibility with Apple Watch. HamSat is available on the iPhone App Store. And thanks to Peter, G0ABI, for throwing that information our way. I don't use HamSat, but maybe I'll download it for free and take a look and maybe upgrade. We'll see. The upper stage from a commercial Chinese rocket that launched last week has broken apart in space, spreading debris in a heavily trafficked part of low Earth orbit, home to the International Space Station and a significant portion of SpaceX's Starlink broadband network. The breakup occurred shortly after the, this is a Chinese word, something 2E rocket, reached orbit on June 9 with two satellites providing direct-to-cell communications, perhaps around the time the upper stage was expected to perform a disposal burn. The U.S. Air Force confirmed the breakup event, stating there are currently no threats to human spaceflight. That's a nice thing. And this story came from ARSTechnica.com. We do have links to all these stories up on AmSatNet.com if you'd like to peruse the original story. A new paper from researchers at NASA's Ames Research Center in California reports that 73.3% of images the agency's new Sphere X space telescope collected between May and September of last year were contaminated by at least one artificial satellite trail. Typically, this type of light pollution is associated with ground telescopes, but SphereX is an orbital satellite about 700 kilometers above the Earth's surface. Apparently, even that wasn't enough to escape from the light trails. And this comes from spectrum.ieee.org. A dazzling fireball streaked through the skies above the Midwest on June 14th, crashing through the Earth's atmosphere at a staggering 56,000 miles per hour before burning up. More than 500 witnesses reported the event to the American Meteor Society, some of whom uploaded footage of the fiery event. NASA's All-Sky Camera Network also captured the fireball from three locations. Ooh, I need to reset the repeater. Sorry. Okay, we're back, KK5DO. Let's see, where were we here? NASA saw it on all three of their locations. Okay, so that story came from space.com, so we thank them for that. An Ariane 6 with upgraded solid rocket boosters successfully launched 36 Amazon LEO satellites June 17th. So far, 367 Amazon LEO satellites have launched on Ariane 6, Atlas 5, and Falcon 9. However, there is only one more Atlas 5 launch for Amazon LEO scheduled for July 3rd, forcing Amazon to lean more on Arianespace. The company still has a July 29 deadline to deploy the full constellation as part of the FCC's waiver decision on June 5th. And that story comes from spacenews.com. And last week or the week before, I read that entire story about what happened and how SpaceX Starlink benefited by this. So that'll be interesting to see what happens in the long term. NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman responding to questions about the agency's selection of an all-male crew for the Artemis III mission, said the astronauts were chosen based solely on their experience, skill sets, and availability. Isaacman strongly defended the crew selection, saying he had personally been to space twice with 50% female crews. My closest advisors and some of the smartest engineers I know are women. In our latest NASA leadership organization, nearly 50% of the center directors and mission directorate leadership are women. So that one comes from Space Flight Now. And that does it for the AMSAT News Service Bulletins. Thanks to Mark K0JM, who is this week's editor. Now, let me just take a quick look at email, see if there was anything very important there. And I don't see. So we will move on to these other very interesting stories that I found. This one is about the astronauts aboard the International Space Station. And they can see flashes of light even with their eyes closed. And it doesn't come from light entering the eye, but from high-energy space particles passing through their body and triggering the retina or visual pathway directly. Now, this story was written by the Space Daily editorial team, and it was published June 23rd, which is today. So this is a really new story, and here's what they've got. Float in a darkened module on the International Space Station. Close your eyes and wait. Before long, most astronauts report the same thing. An occasional flash, a spot or a short streak of light against the dark behind their eyelids. No light is reaching them. The flashes are made by particles from space passing straight through the eye. To the crews, it is an old and familiar oddity. To everyone else, it tends to sound invented. It is neither. And it has been documented and measured for more than a half century. First noticed on the way to the moon, the astronauts of Apollo were the first to describe it. Buzz Aldrin mentioned seeing the flashes during Apollo 11 in 1969. Once his eyes had adjusted to the dark of the cabin, and other crews soon reported the same thing. When they paid attention, they counted them, roughly one every few minutes. NASA took it seriously enough to fly an instrument for it. On later Apollo missions, a device strapped to the astronaut's head recorded the tracks of charged particles while the wearer noted each flash, so the two could be matched. What is actually happening? The culprit is cosmic rays, fast-moving protons and heavier atomic nuclei flung across the galaxy by violent events and arriving with enormous energy. Out beyond much of the Earth's protective shielding, they pass through most of everything aboard a spacecraft, including the people inside it. When one passes through an eye, it can produce a flash in more than one way. It can ionize the retina directly, plowing through the light-sensing cells and exciting them as if they had caught a photon. It can also generate a faint but genuine glow through a process called Cherenkov radiation. When a particle moves through the fluid of the eye faster than light itself travels in the fluid, the retina then registers that glow as it would any other. Either way, the brain receives a signal it can only read as light, measuring something you cannot photograph. Pinning this down meant catching the particle and the sensation together, and the Russian station Mir, and later on the ISS experiments called SIL-I, and then Altea, placed silicone particle detectors around an astronaut's head, logging each particle's path while the astronaut marked every flash. The records lined up. Heavy, high-energy nuclei and energetic protons were the ones setting off the flashes by both the direct and Chernikov routes. The broad picture is settled. The finer detail which particles matter most and how much of the effect happens in the retina rather than deeper along the visual pathway is still being worked out. Why is it more than a curiosity? The flashes are the only part of the space radiation environment a person can actually perceive. Each one is, in effect, the track of a single cosmic ray particle through living tissue, briefly made visible. That is also why they are studied rather than simply noted. The same particles that produce harmless flashes are the ones that raise long-term questions for astronauts, eyes, and central nervous systems on extended missions. The flash itself passes in an instant. What it marks, a steady arrival of high-energy radiation, does not. What to watch? The effect scales with exposure, and exposure rises sharply away from Earth. The space station still sits partly within the planet's magnetic shelter, while a crew bound for Mars would have none of it, and would see the flashes more often as the dose climbed. That makes the phenomenon a small personal readout of one of the central problems of long-duration spaceflight, working out how to shield a crew from that radiation over a journey measured in years rather than months is the part still waiting to be solved. And that's the end of that story. And that's rather interesting. The link to this is up there at amsatnet.com if you're interested. And again, it came from the Space Daily team. So we thank them for that very interesting story. And we'll go ahead and reset the repeater on Echolink so that everyone is happy. Okay, all done. Now, I got another story I found over on spacedaily.com. Voyager 1 has been traveling nonstop since 1977, faster than a speeding bullet every second of every day, and it has not yet reached the distance of a single light year from Earth. Okay, so here's the story. Voyager 1 is the fastest and most distant object people have ever built. It left Earth in 1977, and almost a half a century later, it is still moving at about 17 kilometers every second, far quicker than any rifle bullet. By that measure, it holds a record. Nothing else comes near. And yet, after all that time and all that speed, it has not covered even, okay, listen to this one, 300th of the way to a single light year. Both of these things are true at once, and the gap between them is the real story. Fast by human standards, Voyager 1 launched in September 1977 and has been coasting ever since. It has no engine running. Its speed of roughly 17 kilometers a second, about 61 kilometers an hour, is momentum it gathered from the planets it swung past, and it has held that pace since its last encounter with Saturn in 1980. It now sits about 170 times further from the Sun than Earth, a distance of roughly 25 billion kilometers. In 2012, it crossed the heliopause, the boundary where the Sun's bubble of particles gives way to interstellar space, becoming the first spacecraft to operate between the stars. As a feat of distance and endurance, nothing else made by people is in the same range. What a light year does to the picture. The difficulty is the unit. A light year is the distance light travels in a year, about 9.5 trillion kilometers, or some 63,000 times the gap between the Earth and the Sun. Voyager 1, for all its speed and all its years, sits at about 170 of those Earth-to-Sun units. That works out to roughly 1/370th of a light year. Put the other way around, at 17 kilometers a second, a full light year would take something like 17,000 years to cross. The nearest star to the Sun, Proxima Centauri, is more than 4 light years away. Voyager 1 is not aimed at it, or at any star in particular. In about 40,000 years, it will pass within roughly 1.6 light years of a faint star called Galois 445. And that is as near to another sun as its path will take it. A light day reached this year. There is a smaller milestone that makes the scale easier to feel. NASA expects that in November 2026, Voyager 1 will become the first human-made object a full light day from Earth, the point at which a radio signal takes about a day to reach it and another day to come back. It has taken nearly 49 years to reach one light day. A light year is 365 times further again. The power is running out. None of this will be tracked by instruments for much longer. Voyager 1 runs on heat from decaying plutonium, and that supply has been fading by about 4 watts a year. It began with about 470 watts and is now well under half of that. To stretch what remains, engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory have been switching instruments off one at a time. The Cosmic Ray subsystem was shut down in early 2025, and the Low Energy Charge Particle instrument followed in April 2026. Two science instruments are still running, one measuring magnetic fields and one listening to plasma waves. The team has also been preparing a broader power-saving change, tested through the middle of 2026 to buy more time. At some point in the next several years, the available power will fall too low to run anything at all, and Voyager 1 will go quiet. It will not stop. It will keep coasting at the same 17 kilometers a second, dark and silent, through the thousands of years it would take to reach a light year and the tens of thousands to approach another star. What to watch? The near-term markers are concrete. There is the light day crossing in November, and there is the question of how long the final two instruments can be kept alive as the power margin narrows. After that, following Voyager 1 becomes a matter of arithmetic rather than observation. It will hold the speed and heading it has kept since 1980, carrying its golden record outward long after its radio has fallen silent. So that's the end of that story. It came from Space Daily. The link is up there at amsatnet.com. I thought that was rather interesting and shared it with you. And we don't have any more check-ins over on Echolink. And I think I've run to the end of the information I have for this evening. Marty would have had some local check-ins from the Houston area and maybe from some of the repeater links, but I don't have that luxury. So with that, I'm going to say 73, call it a night, and that'll do it for this evening. So this is KK5DO 73. We'll see you next week.